Gas, every Arizona homeowner's best friend.
Come on around back Arizona, Saturday morning, 8 o'clock, the outdoor living hour of Rosie on the House. Your Saturday morning tradition since 1988. If you're following along in your Rosie on the House homeowner handbook, which if you don't have, you can get one for free simply by requesting it. Let us know the address you'd like it sent to. We'll drop it in the mail beginning of next week. And you can see the topics and to-dos that we cover every Saturday morning. You know, this second Saturday of the month is the Ultimate Garden Hour. We've got Justin Rahner in from Agriscaping. And of all the years, Justin, I don't think anyone's ever brought edible flowers as the primary topic.
Well, you know, it's a special topic, and it's actually a really fun one, especially out at the Queen Creek Botanical Garden. It's one of the ways you can taste the beauty out there, and it's a piece that a lot of people kind of don't venture too far into.
And I don't know if you did this on purpose, but you put it on the same weekend as Mother's Day, so you can give her bouquet and eat it too.
You can have your bouquet and eat it too. There you go. That's kind of a piece of it. It was intentional, so It's one of those things that for most times Mother's Day brings that vision of the flowers and having the bouquet that you bring your wife or you bring your mother and have that opportunity. That's my mother's the one who brought me to the garden first. And that's usually the story for most people that love gardening. It's their mothers that brought them into the garden. And to have that beauty surround you and to have those flowers that you can bring as something you cultivated with your mother. I mean, In my garden, I've got a number of varieties of flowers that come from my grandma and my mother and my great-grandma. So it's like there's a history of motherhood that is cultivated in my own garden, and I find that to be true for many people. They're reminded by their mothers or of the good times with their mothers from flowers and other things like that. So it is very intentional. So
if you'd like to join the conversation, ask questions about your landscape garden or edible landscape, 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you. Jess is here. We'll get your zip code that you're calling from, or the property that you're calling about, your name, and we'll get you on air with Justin Rahner. You can also text questions to 411-923 or email info@rosieonthehouse.com if you need to send an image or a short video for plant or insect identification. But as we make our way through our topic, the first question, you're talking about, you know, the beauty and your mother and your grandmother and all these things. So why would you want to eat the flower then?
Well, in most plants, the pinnacle of their existence isn't necessarily the fruit. It's the flower. It's the thing that creates the most attractive component, which means that a lot of the nutrients are all put into the effort of producing a flower. And with that, a lot of the medicines that we have in the world today are actually derived from flowers. It's from the flower part. And oils, you know, a lot of those things too. And inside of finding that many are edible, it's kind of fun to realize that because of their edibility, they also have some value to us nutritionally. I mean, one of my favorite ones that I guess is probably the one I eat the most is the pansy flower or anything in that viola family. And that's because I grew up with a lot of allergies. And later in life, I learned from a naturopathic doctor that a lot of the same ingredients in the medicines and the stuff that I was taking was actually already natively inherent inside of the pansy or the viola flower. And so that was part of my recipe for improving my own health was eating a few pansy flowers if I had allergy symptoms. And I found that not only did they have a relatively nice flavor, they also helped heal my body in a way that I hadn't experienced outside of medicine.
So just because they're edible, does that mean they're good?
No.
Are you like Crocodile Dundee-ing us where he's like making her eat the bugs and she's like, aren't you going to have any? He's like, well, you can live off of it, but I'm not eating that. And he pulls out a can of beans or something.
Right. I mean, you know, Elmer's glue is edible, I heard. So, you know, it's not necessarily mean that it's tasty or it's really even good for you. But at the same time, you know, there's other things that are incredibly edible that we can eat. In terms of the flower world, there's a lot of flowers that are incredibly edible. One that a lot of people don't realize, it comes from a flower, but red zinger tea is actually derived from a Jamaican hibiscus, or they call it a roselle. And that particular flower is amazing. I mean, it's got a wonderful, almost a sweet and sour kind of flavor and a beautiful red color and very healthy and stuff as well. So there is a range of what's edible and tasty versus, you know, nasty. And And one of my favorites is actually starting to bloom right now here in the desert, and that is actually the it's the petals off of the pineapple guava. And the pineapple guava has been used for decades as a beautiful landscape plant, nice evergreen. But that one in particular, it tastes like cotton candy straight off the plant. And it is a delight to anybody who has one. They forget eating the fruit. The fruit doesn't taste nearly as good as the flower petal. And so the flowers, I mean, they can surprise you.
So you kind of answered the next question was kind of rolling around in my head. What are we eating the petal? Are we eating the stem? Are we eating the leaves? Is it different for each plant itself?
Different for each plant. I mean, in some things like even amaranth, you can actually eat pretty much everything about it, but you're going to have a different flavor profile for different parts, you know, the flower versus the petals, you know, those kind of things. Same with the roselle. The roselle flower has a flavor, the petals itself, and then there's a roselle that it kind of forms after, a kind of a chalice around the seed pod. That's the tastiest part, but then you've also got petals or the leaves that also have a sour flavor, almost kind of a cranberry-like kind of flavor with the leaves. And that's a great summer edible that hopefully a lot of people are starting to grow right now because it's a great one.
A lot of people will say, you know, if you have allergies, eat local honey because the honey bees are, you know, pollinating whatever's in season right now. So are we eliminating the job of the honeybee just by going straight to the flower and just stick your head in that pollen and eat it up?
Yeah, that's one way to take it. I mean, it's very true. I mean, that's another one of the techniques for helping with my allergies was eating local honey. And then eating local flowers that are edible also helps with that because one of the reasons that your body becomes allergic or has that reaction, it's overreacting to something that's not in it or not. It's foreign. So it's taking things that are surrounding you and calling them foreign and then reacting to that, hyperactive. And so if you start intaking those types of things in small quantities, like having the honey with a little bit of that pollen and the enzymes all with it and stuff, it has your body then become more resilient to the things that are naturally around you, which a lot of the things people are allergic to come along the path of pollen. And so another great way to do it, eat the flower rather than just having it touch your body or smell it through your nose, you know, make it part of you.
And some people, you know, when we go through these list of edible flowers that you've got here from your edible flower calendar, and we'll get to those varieties, but some of them would look and say, well, this isn't a flower, it's a weed.
Well, you know, a weed, what do they say? You know, a weed's just a plant in the wrong place at the wrong time. You know, it's more about understanding its utility and making sure that it's intentionally planted. I think it turns any weed into a beautiful addition to your garden. Even dandelions, right? So dandelions, wonderful medicinal plant, also has a great flavor to it. We eat the leaves, especially during the wintertime. You can get the sweet dandelions. I found the ones with the rounder and the leaf have a sweeter flavor. The wild greens is what you'll find them in the store, often sold as. So it's just packaged a little differently than dandelion, and it usually ends up being sold as a good medicinal and very highly valued plant.
I was watching a video, and I'll embed it into today's podcast page on our website, from a guy that was just went on and on and on for like 2.5 minutes about all the benefits of dandelion. He's like, you know, don't take out the weed killer and spray it like they try and convince you. He's like, this is gold growing in your yard.
Very true. And it has a beautiful golden flower, too, to go along with it. Now, I've never eaten or found any value of the seed pods, you know, the little fluffy things, except to blow them in the wind and enjoy the fact that it might be growing in someone else's yard as it flies off. But it is a, you know, kind of a fun experience, especially with little kids. But for the entire plant itself, yeah, there's a lot of value to it, especially when even before it flowers or just as it flowers, that's when its flavor is usually the best.
We're probably pretty pressed. Pretty far past the prime of, you know, the Arizona wildflower season, you know, early springtime, you know, especially around Picacho, the African poppies, they're these beautiful orange colors.
Yeah.
And are those edible?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you get into the poppy family, you know, it's arguable if they're edible or not, or medicinal, or just a straight-out drug. And with the ones that we have here, the California poppy, the African poppy, those ones, I wouldn't recommend eating those in any measure just because they have a little bit more of that, the other side, the drug side. And it's not the good side of the drug, if there is a good side to the drug. It's something to stay away from on that. I mean, there's also lupines out there and stuff. I like those more, I mean, for foraging, like for my animals and stuff. Great, great, great plants. But in the desert right now, some of the things that I'm eating that are flowering right now is actually your desert, the desert willow. So the desert willow has a beautiful flower on it, and they vary in flavor. I find that the lighter the color, the sweeter the flavor, the more dark the color, the more bitter the flavor. So something to pay attention to, but that is in that family of edible flowers is the desert willow.
And on that topic of kind of following up on that, you know, maybe stay away from anything that has a name poppy in it, you know, what else do we need to be worried about? You know, like, if we're going to go try some edibles, you know, that are out there, what would you naturally know to stay away from? Or,
well, I mean, in general, stay away from flowers. I mean, and it sounds kind of odd because we're talking about edible flowers. And so getting the knowledge of edible flowers is an important piece of your puzzle. And some of the things I guess I'd say to stay away from, the other thing is sourcing. I mean, and we'll probably get to this more even in a little bit in the next segment, is into sourcing and identifying, making sure that your sources fit and match an edible opportunity. Because you get into some flowers are grown specifically just to be beautiful and to be very productive on the flower side, but they have systemic pesticides that are infused into their soil base, which is not something that you want to eat, because that systemic pesticide is now infused into every cell in the flower and the plant, and that's there to kill a bug. And so if something's there to kill a bug, it's probably not there to help you.
The Ultimate Garden Hour here at Rosie on the House with Justin Ronner of Agriscaping. The topic today is edible flowers, but we're also here for you, the Arizona homeowner. 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you if you'd like to speak with Justin, or you can text questions to 411-923 like Dan, who wants to know how many gallons of water do I need to put on a mature 40-year-old elm tree?
Well, it really depends on the size and where it's located in his yard. But what we're trying to achieve is get the amount of gallons of water so that we can get the water to at least 3 feet deep on a tree that big every time you water, and then across the entire root zone, which the root zone is going to be all the way out to the outside of the canopy of that tree. And we want to get the majority of that water really in that major root zone. So from the outermost part of the drip zone of that tree, the outermost of the leaves, all the way up to about a foot and a half from the trunk is all that major water-loving root zone. So how many gallons is a hard one to figure? Because your soil is going to make a difference too. If your soil is well-draining and I put 100 gallons onto one spot, I'm not watering my entire tree. But if I've got really clay soil and I've got the same 100 gallons and I put it in one spot, it's likely going to spread out and only about a gallon is going to get, you know, in any part of it, and the rest is going to go away. So it really depends on your scenario. But a tree that big, that large, you're talking at least, and those elms are kind of fidgety too. If you don't got good drainage, if you put too much water on, it's going to rot the root and the tree's going to die in an instant. And you can even do that with a very large tree. So part of my recommendation, I guess, it's maybe that's a long way of saying it depends. Yeah, but the issue is more about depth of water than it is about the exact number of gallons. We want to get water to a depth of 3 feet out in that root zone. And the way to test that is to get a probe. Usually we'll get a piece of rebar, put a little 4-foot piece of number 3 rebar. We'll bend the 6 inches at the end to give myself a bit of a handle. We're going to water it as we hope is the correct amount of water. We're going to go to that root zone, and we're going to just press down that probe into the ground, and it should move relatively easily until it hits a dry point. And then let's say I put the timer on and I watered it for 30 minutes and I only got down a foot, I'm going to want to triple the amount of time. I don't want to increase the volume that I'm putting on the tree. I just want to triple the time so I can try to get it to that third foot. And then I'm going to water it again for an elm. I'm going to let that top 1 to 2 inches dry out. before I'd water it again, because it benefits from letting the roots really fully kind of rinse through before you then water it again. And so that's my approach to then figure out how much time relative to the volume of water that whatever my system is using to get to the depth I need. And if the water's not going very deep and I'm getting pooling everywhere else but around my tree and I'm not getting it deep, I need to slow down the flow rate of my water. So you may get drip emitters on there, put them to 2 gallons per hour, let it run for 16 hours just to get it to slowly perk down. And then if you do the math on that, 16, let's say I've got three of those, you know, I'm about 115 gallons of water for that particular tree in that circumstance. And again, it's your circumstance, your soil conditions, what else is going on around it. That's going to make the biggest difference on how much water to water my tree.
All right, Dan, there's a lot of information there for you to get to work with. And the most critical thing, I think, in all of that is get that soil prod. You talked about just getting a piece of rebar. I spent $40 to actually get a soil prod that's a fiberglass. It's got a T-handle on it, and you push it. And like you said, not only as it's watering, but the next day, the next day, the next day. So you can visually see how fast the water's drying up so you know when to hit it again. So that changed my world, was getting the soil prod. But before this segment wraps up, before the bottom of the hour news break, let's talk about the additional benefits of flowers before we get into what edible flowers we can grow here in Arizona.
Well, benefits of flowers, obviously it's a beautiful addition. If you want to get kids to eat salad, you know, put something colorful in it. And if you got some fun, colorful things, and you'll find the kids are the most willing to try an edible flower, especially if you can let them know, it's like, oh, isn't it pretty? It tastes good too. You know, get some good ones that are in there. So benefits, it increases your health. It increases the color and the diversity of the nutrients that you're bringing into your salads. It adds some pop and color to almost any dish. I mean, a lot of edible flowers that you'll see on our list are ones that are used for kind of on table settings and stuff like that, or might be even used like a pansy flower on cake and cake decorating. You know, a lot of wedding cakes are decorated with pansies. They'll even candy them and make them even more interesting. So they have a cool kind of almost look like they're frozen kind of look to them, but it's just crystallized sugar on the end of that flower. So there's a lot of really fun stuff that you can do with the flowers. And then medicinally, like we've talked about, there's some value to a lot of flowers in your life just with that.
And if you're doing your own type of agriscaping and you've got, you know, a couple neighbors that you're providing fruits and vegetables to, you know, this could be one more thing, you know, have your decorative display every now and then. Or is there any kind of soil benefit that this, you know, like a lot of times you see, you know, farmers will rotate crops or they'll plant this after that because like in alfalfa, they'll put in sedan hay every couple years to reverse the nitrogen composition of the soil, yada, yada, yada. Is there anything like that with rotating? Like I did a vegetable garden here. Now I'm going to do a flower garden here and rotate it with my vegetable garden over here.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just like in the world of plants, it's like flowering things come in all categories. And, you know, you got roots, fruits, beans, and greens. And so if I need a root type crop to help dig my soil for me and I don't have to do all the tilling, well, then I might pick a sunflower or an amaranth, which has a nice taproot that burrows down into the ground, and it's of great benefit to my soil. Then I've got pea flowers and pea-type flowers that increase the nitrogen before I plant my greens and other vegetables. And so, yeah, they fit every category of need, flowers.
All right. We're going to get into all those different varieties that we can plant, harvest, and grow here in the great state of Arizona, and particularly the desert floor for edible flowers.
How many kinds of sweet flowers grow in an English country garden? Daffodil, heartsease, and phlox, meadowsweet, and lady smocks, gentian, lupin, and tall hollyhocks, roses, foxgloves, snowdrops, forget-me-nots.
Do we just let this song play? Or does
it's pretty
do
good.
All of our work for us?
I want to know how many of those you can eat.
Well, a good majority of them, actually, but there's one in there that I would say absolutely do not eat that one, and that's foxglove.
Okay.
So they did mention that one. That's one to stay away from. It's a beautiful flower. There is some medicinal value to it, but not likely in the quantity that, I mean, just you got to be careful with that one. But great intro. Thank you. That was awesome. And it also kind of dives into a little bit of the caveat. It's like, oh no, although there are many edible flowers, they can also be sprayed with pesticides. You got to really pay attention to your source. Make sure you're getting it from a source that's growing them or starting them with the intention to eat it. Because if it's been grown with only the intention to look good, it's likely got those systemic pesticides we talked about before. And then make sure that you're not eating from an area that might have other types of pesticides that have been sprayed around. Because just like your food source, you don't want to be eating the pesticide, you want to be eating the food. And flowers in particular, if you're spraying pesticides on flowers, they soak up the pesticide a lot more than your fruits do. You can't just wash it off. And so you want to make sure that you're using more natural type pesticides or deterrents that would be more conducive to eating the thing that you're spraying. And the other thing too is, like, when you pick a flower and you're going to eat it, make sure to kind of blow it off at least a little bit or rinse it off. I mean, some of them don't wash well, but just to make sure there's no extra bugs or protein you didn't anticipate for your meal there.
You don't want to eat the bugs?
No, the bugs are not so tasty. But a lot of these can be very tasty, and there's a lot of use. So on our edible flower guide, you can get it at agriscaping.com. Just sign up for our newsletter. You also get access to a free membership. And in that free membership is the edible flower guide that you can print out for yourself. And there's a wealth of information on there. I'm going to go through as many as I can just to kind of share with you so you can see the variety of things that are growing, especially right now. I mean, summertime, we got the amaranth we talked about before. You got beautiful colors, reds, pinks. And it's a spring plant that kind of blooms in the summer, very spinach-like leaf. Has a lightly sweet flavor of the flower cluster. That's kind of my favorite part. It's got a lightly sweet flavor. Beautiful in salads, stir fries, or even as cut flowers, because they are a beautiful cut flower. And grow in multiple microclimates. So a B, C, and an A, which is really the hottest areas of your garden, can still grow an amaranth.
And you have it listed here as an annual. So does that mean I can cut it and it'll come back? I can cut it, it'll come back? Or...
Well, in an annual, in this case, it's only gonna grow for a season, and then it's gonna really die back. These things will die back in the wintertime. They have kind of a hollow stalk, very similar. They'll grow very fast and very tall. There's some varieties of amaranth that'll grow 8 to 10 feet tall, and there's others like Love Lies Bleeding that actually it's more hangs on the ground and have these beautiful trailing clusters of flowers, a beautiful red color. And so these ones, I'll grow it through the spring and summer. I'm going to cut it out in the fall and plant something else. But they do reseed themselves pretty well. And the little shoots, you'll actually find amaranth seed is a wonderful seed. So it's not just the flower, the seed that you end up getting, wonderful, healthy grain alternative, you know, a gluten-free grain alternative that you can pop like you could, popcorn. Makes a fun little kind of little puffed treat. Or you can also take that seed and then replant it, and then the shoots is one of the best the microgreens is amaranth. Microgreens are very delectable, wonderful thing that you can eat. So other ones we got, bachelor's button or the cornflower. It's another annual one that's not going to be there all the time. It's got some plum colors to blues, even to white. It's a fall plant with a spring bloom. Grows about 12 to 24 inches tall. Also great in salads, garnish, and stemmed decor. You know, putting that in a nice little vase and things like that, a little on the medium size. Mild flavor, light texture, holds up its shape really well if you wash it or put it in other things. So it can handle even mixing it into dishes and things like that. It's a pretty fun one. Bee balm's the first on the list that we've got that is actually a perennial. So it'll grow year-round. Got purples, reds, and pinks, and even whites. It's a summer blooming flower. The petals are the best. It's got a mild, sweet flavor, and it attracts hummingbirds and butterflies. So, you know, that's one of those that you can throw in drinks, you can throw in salads, you can put it in even ice cream as kind of a little add-on in an ice cream that works pretty well. And so there's a lot of great stuff. We're getting into celosia season, which is like a dwarf amaranth. A lot of people plant celosia, don't realize that that's edible. It's in the same family as amaranth, but they're like dwarf amaranth. And there's a lot of Japanese varieties and stuff as well, kimonos, that have a little bit more of a bittersweet flavor in their flower cluster. So we tend to lean more towards the savory items and places that you can put that, or as garnishments, stir fries, so it does hold up well even with some heat and keeps its color pretty well. And it's one of my favorite replacements of croutons. If you don't want to have croutons in your salad, but you still want something that can kind of soak up a little extra salad dressing, the celosia is actually one that does that pretty well.
For a lot of these annuals, you know what I'm picturing is your buddy Billingsley, his Flower Street Urban Garden, you know, systems just being the perfect place to grow these.
They are great, and that's a great place to grow, especially anything that's under a foot tall. If you got them more than a foot tall, you can only put them in the top row of Alex's Flower Street Urban Gardens, but they look beautiful when you put them up there. It's like, I haven't seen one before, but I wonder what amaranth growing, you know, 8 feet tall above a wall would look like. If you really need to shield a second story neighbor, that might actually work.
your privacy flower at your privacy edible screen.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, another one of my favorite ones, not so much a good screen, but a good ground growing plant in the through the summer months is the daylily. Now, there's some varieties of daylily. The whole flower you can actually put. They serve them as delectable hors d'oeuvres, you know, in high-end restaurants. They'll have stuffed daylily flowers, and they are amazing. My wife, one of her favorite flowers, it tastes kind of peachy. It tastes like a peach, so it's almost juicy. The petals and everything about it is what we eat on those. And there's purple, reds, pinks, yellows, a lot of amazing color. You can add them to drinks. I mean, they're just beautiful, the petals themselves. Those aren't ones, because they're so pretty, it's like we don't juice these ones, you know. We want to just eat the whole thing, you know, or use it like, put some compote inside of there, make a nice hors d'oeuvre stuffed with some cream cheese kind of filling with some herbs in it and stuff would be amazing.
Now, on a couple of these, it lists drinks. Mm-hmm. This it would be like adding mint is what I'm picturing. Not like you're juicing it to drink. You're adding it as a garnish.
You're adding it as a garnish to the drink, adds a little bit of flavor to it if you can kind of steep it with it. I mean, like lavender, that's a good one that's a little deeper in the list. It's like a lavender lemonade. So you make the lemonade the day before. You throw some of your lavender flowers into your lemonade with a couple of sliced lemons and let it just steep overnight, like on your counter before you put the ice in. And it'll infuse the lemonade with this wonderful lavender essence. And it's got a wonderful flavor to it. And then you add the ice and stuff and kind of locks it in. And now you've got this wonderful chilled lavender lemonade that you can have. So that's another way of using these drink ones.
I love it.
It's great. Dianthus, that's another great one, has a little bit more of a peppery flavor. We just eat the petals on that. That'll grow almost through the entire summer as well. I've got it as a fall to winter bloom, but they can extend their season pretty long. Beautiful flower. And it's important, too. Another cool thing about eating flowers is by eating the flowers and pulling them off and eating them, you're actually exciting the flower, the plant itself, to grow more flowers. I mean, some people call it deadheading. We'll usually pick the flower for eating just before it's dead. So as it just starts to wilt, like the pansy flower, just starts to curl a little bit, doesn't look its prettiest, that's when I'm going to pull that off and I'm going to eat that. And then it'll basically helps the plant say, hey, we need more flowers. And it'll just pop out more flowers for you.
What's that tree that when you kill it, it shoots, sends all the roots off?
Sisu tree?
Yeah, it sounds like the sisu of the flower world.
There we go. But most flowers, they benefit from that, and you do too. So it's not like the sisu where we don't really benefit from. It's sprouting itself back up. Another great one during the summer months, the hollyhock. Very beautiful, tall, growing flower. That one has a great stem, good root builder right there too. Pinks and reds and oranges. There's even double blooming ones that look almost like roses, like tall upright roses, great cut flowers, stem decor. I mean, you can stack them. If you've ever seen a hollyhock, it's like a pioneer flower. It's one of the most valued pioneer flowers because you can just scatter the seeds in an area. They grow themselves very well. They leave great soil behind, especially if you just cut them out. They create these nice hollow channels where the water can move a lot deeper, create a lot more microbial activity. So it's a great flower for a precursor to your fall garden. So if you've got a hard area in your yard that you'd like to grow this coming fall, hollyhocks, sunflowers, amaranth, great ones to seed in now and let them grow up because they'll start digging that soil for you without much effort.
Now, a lot of these color-wise, red, pink, orange, yellow, pretty consistent, but you've got lavender here on here, which is one of the few that brings in the purples and the blues.
Yep. And it is tougher to find the purples and the blues in the flower world in the edible space. I mean, there's plenty of purple flowers out there that aren't edible, but in the edibles, and it's really important, I think, to stick to the flowers that you know are edible. So get this guide. Highly recommend just getting this edible flower guide for yourself. These are a lot of the top flowers. We've got pictures in it as well as helping you know exactly where to plant them, where they'll do best, what time to plant them. And giving you that flavor profile so that you're not overly surprised. Like the nasturtium is a bold, spicy flavor with a hint of honey. And you need to know that it's spicy before you eat it because it looks like something that might be sweet because of how pretty it is. But it's one that definitely on the spicy side, and it will surprise you if even the leaves are spicy. But that one, ironically, is my favorite one to put in ice cream.
Oh.
So good friend of mine, Chef Brad, if you've ever seen any of Chef Brad videos, he does a lot of work with grains and ancient grains and wonderful stuff. I mean, the sourdough world loves this guy. So he loves to get into the nasturtium. That's one of his favorite things. He made a nasturtium ice cream that I got to taste, and it was amazing. And oddly enough, as it gets cold, the ice, as it's in the, it keeps its color, it keeps its structure, so you have this beautiful pop of oranges and reds and yellows. It holds that, but then it loses that spiciness, just enough that you don't, it's not overtaking or overpowering. It's got this wonderful, interesting flavor. So a vanilla-type base or a cream base with the nasturtium is a wonderful, fresh, homemade ice cream that you might love and enjoy.
And you've got pansies on here. That's a pretty commonly grown flower here in Arizona.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in the wintertime.
I never thought of eating one, but yeah, I've planted plenty of them.
That's good, and it's a top one on the list. And along with petunias, that's another one. It's got a velvety texture, so not everybody loves velvety texture on their tongue. So that's another one that it's nice to note that it's got a little fuzz to it. And but it is a semi-sweet. We find that the lighter the color in the world of the petunias, the sweeter the flavor. So the white ones tend to be the sweetest. And as we get into the darker colors, like the blacks, we find them to be more bitter. And if you think about food coloring, it follows a similar pattern. The more food coloring you often drip into your thing, whatever you're creating, it's going to have a bitter taste to it. And similar in the flower world, the darker the petal or the deeper the color, the likelihood of it being a little bit more on the bitter side is higher. And if it's got a lighter color, it's got a little less of the pigments, and the pigments are the things that make it a little bit more on the bitter side.
So those are just a few of them. You can get this entire edible flower guide at agriscaping.com. A snapdragon, sunflower, viola, violet, sweet are also all on the list. When we get back, we're going to bring Matt into the conversation, talk about how to manage a ficus hedge right here at Rosie on the House. Very interesting topic today, talking edible flowers. Have a couple final points that we'll make here as we wrap up this segment. But first, Matt has called in at 1-888-767-4348. That's 1-888-ROSIE for you and wants to join the conversation. Matt, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Good.
My question is, I have a tall wall in the backyard over the pool of four ficus trees that are about, 40 feet tall. So I keep them trimmed back so it's only a mild canopy. The issue is I'm putting in new flooring around the pool. So before it was gravel and cool deck, now I'm putting in limestone. There will be a ramada, but I'm already noticing a little bit of those little figs or little fruit that they drop that I'm going to have to start cleaning. I'm not sure if there's anything more I could or should do other than just sealing the limestone flooring.
Can you eat them?
Well, you can kind of eat those. They are a fig, but it's not the tastiest. There's not much flavor around them. It's mostly just seeds. It is a seasonal thing, relatively speaking. Part of my concern for those ficus trees is going to be basically you're shifting it from a space that could percolate water. Now it's not going to be able to percolate the water as well in that space. And so getting it to make sure that they stay healthy, I guess, and making sure that you have a good watering system, you might need to update the watering system to accommodate the shift that you're making around the trees and the roots to make sure that they still stay healthy. The other piece of the puzzle, because one of the things, they'll produce more of those little fruits if they're stressed, which is weird, but that's kind of how they work. If you have a really healthy, if you're always giving a good amount of nitrogen, you're going to reduce its willingness to create the fruits, which will reduce the drop. And so nitrogen is one of your best additives, getting some good ironite into the soil because they've been around a long time. You're going to probably need to create a little bit more intention behind adding the nitrogen to the soil, getting some root injections possibly to be able to then just fortify the plant's ability to grow its leaf over fruit. And that should help out a lot in terms of the long-term maintenance. I mean, this doesn't sound like it's much of a hedge as much as it is a huge canopy that you've got for your space. And then also fortifying with a balanced nutrient base too would also help it hold its leaves. Because one thing about ficus trees is that they are evergreen, but it all, what evergreen often means is that it's going to be dropping stuff all the time. And so if you can get it to hold onto a leaf longer before it puts out a new sprouted leaf, that's of benefit to you and obviously to reduce the amount of care that is needed for the area. So if you don't have a good mulch around the bases of the roots, make sure that you are injecting some other fertilizers down inside that then support the leaf growth over fruit growth on those trees. Hopefully that helps.
Okay, thank you.
All right, we appreciate the call. Now, in addition to edible flowers, there's a lot of things in our desert that grow naturally that people can eat. And well, the first thing that comes to mind is prickly pear.
Yep, prickly pear. Now, people don't usually think to eat that one either, do they? Unless you know about it.
Well, and harvesting something with a lot of thorns, you know, what we have found best, and it doesn't matter, you're still going to get thorns. Just get that in your mind.
Correct.
Is barbecue tongs to pull the fruits off.
Yep.
And then put them on the grill and burn off all the little needles before you do anything with it. Or, you know, like one of those little, you know, even a little hand torch just to.
Yep. Toasting those off, get them all just crispy off of that. And then my favorite way to eat them is actually to kind of stew them down. And then you could sieve off. And so everything, all the good juices and everything kind of go through the sieve. And then you leave all the thorny, because some of those have thorns going right through the center of them too. I mean, there's fibers going through the fruit. You can't just go and, once you get all the spines off, you can't just go and bite into it and eat it and think you're going to get something wonderful. You know, you might just get a pain in the mouth. I mean, literally.
I've got a recipe for prickly pear jelly that I've made a few times. Now, it's never really turned into jelly. It results more like prickly pear syrup.
Yeah, that's kind of how I have. Yeah, I like a prickly pear syrup is actually wonderful. And then even freezing them down, I mean, you have to add a little bit more pectin to get it to really jelly up. But you can use other types of fruit pectins that'll help it kind of solidify. And fruit pectin works similar to kind of how Jell-O does. You know, it just kind of thickens up into more of more like a jelly, more like a jam, probably more on the jam or the preserves side of things.
Have you ever eaten the petal of the prickly pear?
Absolutely. So usually the prickly pear, there's ones that are cultivated specifically. They call it like an Indian fig cactus or a thornless fig cactus or a thornless pad cactus. There's different varieties that you can get that definitely, I mean, we cultivate them. We got one of our Fab Five families, our family assisted build families up in North Mesa. And we've been helping them cultivate those because it's a main staple, it seems like, in their diet, in their family. Platanos, I think is what they call it in Spanish. And it's some wonderful dishes that are straight from the pad of the cactus.
I've even seen occasionally in the produce section that they'll, you know, if you eat it, it's hard to find. It's on the top shelf and,
yeah,
you know, it's kind of in a least looked at place. But, you know, find that spot in your grocery store and
you'll find
very them. Well could find prickly
you can find
pear
some
petals.
Prickly pear pads that you can go and eat. Yep, that's absolutely true. A lot of other stuff that are just starting to ripen out there in the desert right now for all you foragers is the Lycium andersonii, which is a very long way to say wolfberry. So wolfberry has been out here native to Arizona, and it's one of my favorite ones. It's a desert goji. So if you've heard of goji berries being a wonderful plant, a wonderful fruit, the goji in the desert here is even better. And it's got a wonderful flavor, but it varies from even parts of the plant. I know there's a number of trails up off the Superstitions that have them, that you'll find them on the side of beautiful bright orange to red berry at the Riparian Preserve in Gilbert. If you want to try some of those out, they actually have them in the Riparian Preserve at Gilbert. Find a tour guide that can help you see exactly what to eat and how to eat it.
And Charles Kane put a book together, Sonoran Desert Food Plants. So that's something if you want to get into local foraging, might be worth picking that up on your guide. Justin, the website?
Agriscaping.com.
And next month, second Saturday of the month in the Ultimate Garden Hour, we're talking surviving summer heat.